You know, everybody's different. Everybody runs different, races different, eats different, trains different, and tapers different. But you have to find out what works for you and be confident that you can taper and not lose strength and endurance. It's Jimmy Dean trying to break in, that guy. He heard we were podcasting.
Most likely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like the miners game, you know, the gold fever, you know, you get out here and you just get mountain fever. It's beautiful.
You can't be regimented because there's nothing regimented about an ultra marathon. There's so many things that happen along the way that you'll never predict. And so you have to be able to adapt on the fly.
Yeah, but I learned I didn't do that at Western. I had solid legs.
I'm not nervous. I got this. Let's just do it.
Are we recording?
You guys ready?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Recording?
Yeah.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Faith Goss.
And today we have two fantastic runners with us. One fantastic runner that isn't with us is Scott Warr, Faith. What did you do? Did you offend Scott? How come
Scott is sitting on the beaches drinking drinks with small umbrellas out of it.
Is that right? His feet up and recovering from all of his hard work and his training that he's been doing?
Sure is. Maybe he's tapering.
Sounds like a podcast topic, Faith. Did we write this or is this coming off just this corny?
Oh, we're just awesome.
All right. So today our guests joining us are two great runners. One is Katie DeSplinter, and she just completed Western State. So we're going to catch up with her and ask her what her experience is with that. And that's not obviously her first race. She's a accomplished ultra runner, runs with New Balance, the team New Balance, and joining her is Dominic Grossman, who they're currently both in Colorado, and Dominic is about to take on Hard Rock, which Hard Rock 100 is a legendary 100-mile run, very tough to get in, and we're going to talk to him a little bit about getting ready for that, which is perfect for tapering, because if you're going to do a long event, you need to taper a little bit, right, Faith?
I agree. I am on the taper belief train.
Yeah, that's because you are cramming in school like a maniac. So welcome both Katie and Dominic to the podcast, and welcome back to you, Dominic.
Oh, howdy. Glad to be here.
Yep.
Now, this isn't Katie's first experience with Trail Runner Nation, because over at Go Trail Online magazine, which will link to this, she's written a couple of articles, and she is by trade a copyright. Is that right, Katie? Did I say that right?
You said it like Dominic says it. He says the copyright all the time. Well, actually, a copywriter.
She's a copywriter, which means that naturally she can weave with words and create images with her pen.
I'm glad somebody can here.
Thanks, Faith. And so Katie's got some great articles that she's just written and has put them out there in Go Trail. So we'll link one of those, and she ties it in with the podcast. So it's a lot of fun to read, and she's a gifted writer as well as a gifted runner. Tell us a little bit about Western States, Katie.
Oh, man. What do you want to know?
Well, so you came in, and you have a silver buckle. Let's start the conversation with that. How did you do that?
You know, I still am not 100% sure, because I don't know. I've always wanted to. The Western States was my first time ever experiencing a 100-mile race. 3 years ago, Dom and I both crewed Jimmy Dean Freeman, which I know he's done a few podcasts on here as well.
He'll probably try to call in, knowing if he knew this was happening. You'll hear him on Skype trying to get in on the conversation.
Yeah, so that was my first experience ever being at a 100-mile race before, and I remember just thinking it was the craziest thing and that I'd never do that. And of course, just a few months later, Dom had talked me into running Javelina, so then it was kind of all downhill or uphill from there. I don't know what you want to say.
In fact, Katie, that's where I met you, was at Angeles Crest last year, and we ran a portion of that together, and that's when I learned that you were a copywriter.
Yes. Absolutely. So Angeles Crest was like the big race last year for both Dom and I, because we had on our home turf, and we trained a lot. Like every weekend we were up camping. And right before the race, about a month and a half, I fell into a yucca plant. and my knee just was completely jacked up. And long story short, I ended up running the race, but I couldn't bend my knee when I started down in Wrightwood, which probably isn't the best idea. And it ended up just being a really painful experience, but I was glad I did it. And not too long after that, I ended up finding out I had two of the like barbs of the yucca plant still in my knee. So I had to get those surgically removed. And that was in November. And then in December, I went up, you know, right after that, we went up to North Face. I was helping crew Dom. On the way home, they had the Hard Rock Lottery. And of course, we found out he got in, and that was super exciting. And I was still kind of, oh gosh, you know, I put in for all these lotteries. I'm actually glad that I didn't get in because I don't know if my knee is going to be able to handle it. And then the very next week, I ended up getting into Western States, and you're not going to not do Western States. So from then on, it became this really big goal because I was trying to rehab my knee. And then also, I really wanted to, I always said when I did one of those races that has a big lottery, especially something like Western States, I really wanted to give it an honest effort. And I was really concerned about that for the first few months, still trying to rehab my knee. And even in January, I had gone up to the canyons and did like a double canyon run. In fact, I ran into you, Don, didn't I?
Yes.
Vaughn?
Yep.
Dom and I?
Yep, right at the top of Michigan Bluff.
Yeah, so I was feeling good there, but on the way back, my knee was completely wrecked. So I was really honestly scared because I knew there was only so much that I could do to train and try to rehab my knee. And even up until I ran Miwok in May, I was still having some issues. And so I was really fearful because I wanted so bad to, like I said, give it an honest effort. But luckily, I don't know, things just kind of mellowed out. And, you know, I ended up running the whole race with, I had other pains, of course, but but my knee never really actually gave me any trouble. So it ended up working out.
You did give it an honest effort, and such an honest effort that you were able to get the coveted silver belt buckle. Yeah. Talk a little bit about, I mean, the weather this year at States was just, I think, a shock to a lot of people. Did that play into your race at all?
Absolutely, because I have a history of, I've had two races where I've gone completely hypothermic. One that took me out and gave me my only DNF ever. And since then, I've bought a lot of gear, and like a Gore-Tex jacket, a shell, things that would have prevented that. I learned from that. Unfortunately, because no one predicted that this would happen, I had that gear, but it was at home in LA, and there was not really anything I could do. But it was so funny because at the starting line, everybody's like, yeah, you know, they say it's going to rain, but it's not going to be that bad. We're just going to get over the pass and it'll be fine. And everybody seemed to think that. And then, you know, you got up there and first the wind started, and then it was raining, then it was hailing. And then, I don't know, it never went away. Like, you dip down into the canyons and it wasn't too bad, but then you'd get back up on the ridge, and it was getting bad. Like, definitely a lot of people went hypothermic. And I was at, what was that, Miller's Defeat, which is right outside of Robinson. That was the aid station where I went through, and there were tons of people standing around a fire. I actually drank soup.
Katie, we've lost you.
What happened?
It says held remotely. So here's the last we've heard.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Gotcha, yeah.
Sorry, I don't know what, there's a phone, another call came in, and it.
It's Jimmy Dean trying to break in, that guy. He heard we were podcasting.
Most likely.
Yeah. So people were standing around the fire. Let's go back to that. People were standing around the fire.
Yeah, because that was, you know, it was the section coming in there. I think it was so bad because it had kind of gotten better when you went down into Duncan Canyon, which I've run the whole course, and I kind of knew that that's the way it was going to go. Oh, I was going to get in the canyon and I was going to feel better. But then you popped back up out of Robinson and popped back up on that exposed ridge, and it was just like you kind of de-thawed, and then you were freezing again. And, you know, I only had like a little itty bitty, like 2.7 ounce shell. And that's what most people had, or less. And so I think that was kind of the time when everybody was starting to fear, you know, okay, I'm willing to push through this, but at what point is my body just going to shut down? And luckily, after that, you really start rapidly descending when you're heading into dusty corners. And so I just kept thinking, okay, get to the canyons. If my body can just make it to the canyons, I'm going to be okay. And sure enough, right before I got into dusty, you could see out over the canyon and got a nice view that there were clear skies ahead. So that definitely, like I said, I never lost my willingness to do it. It was more, I was really starting to fear that hypothermia was going to set in.
Yeah, that could change your race strategy because you're starting to run maybe a little bit harder and faster to stay warm and then reaching down a little bit deeper into reserves that you need later. Did you have a sense that that might have been going on?
You know, what's really weird is that I never looked at my watch really the whole entire race. I just kind of went in with the attitude that I was going to do the best that I could in every single moment. And like, it's weird. I thought I was capable of going under 24, but I wasn't going to focus on splits or anything like that. So I was running along and like the first, I feel like because I had that attitude, I was adapting a little bit better rather than freaking out about what was happening. And so, you know, my first challenge was that I realized my gel flasks were frozen and I pretty much eat well throughout a race. So I was like, oh, well, this isn't really such a great situation. So I was having to eat more solid food than I normally would. And then the other thing that happened was my hip flexors got so freaking cold that I was in a lot of pain, like in my hips and my abdominals, which is really strange. So I was dealing with that. And then, to your point about running harder, I was getting quite a few comments of I actually ran up and out of Duncan Canyon. I passed probably like 10 or 12 guys and they were all like, what are you doing? Like, I'm trying to stay warm. I'm so cold. It feels better to run right here. And that's, I don't know, I don't really find that canyon very steep. That's not one of the real canyons, I guess.
So
but I don't know. Go ahead.
If you had a choice of a cold year or a hot year, which would you rather run? Because I was thinking how lucky these guys are not to have to deal with the heat. But now that I've heard all the stories, I'm thinking how unfortunate these guys are that they had to run through the, you know, the Arctic conditions.
Well, I don't think it would have been that bad if I would have been more better prepared. Like if I would have had warmer gear, it would have been fine. I just didn't bring that stuff. And it's, I don't know, it's hard to say because I haven't done it in a year that's hot. So while I'd like to say I was heat trained and I tend to do better in the heat than the cold, I don't really know because I haven't done it in a year that's hot. So hopefully I'll do it again one year and then I can tell you.
That'll be good. Now, you guys, I've got to say, maybe the fastest couple in ultra running, right? We've got Dominic who goes out and wins AC last year. So he's just setting all kinds of trails on fire out there. And Katie, you're an accomplished runner too. And with silver hanging around your waist and, you know, you two are tearing it up. And I've got to think that on a month that you get both a Hard Rock pick and a States pick, that you guys should have been in Vegas laying down every dollar and training dollar you had on a number because you were pretty lucky.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely lucky, but it was also kind of a bit of a, you know, a responsibility, or, you know, sort of was like this feeling of, you know, I've got this great honor and, you know, I've got like to do the best that I can this spring and, or this winter and spring and into the summer and make sure I'm ready for the race. And I know Katie was coming back from her knee injury and I was kind of, you know, I was hoping to get into the Hard Rock eventually, but I don't know if I was, you know, 100% ready this year because, you know, like the difference between the San Gabriels in Southern California and the San Juans is, you know, like another 5,000 feet. And that's a big difference with altitude and everything. So it was definitely a huge blessing, but also a bit of a definite
shock
and a lot of work to be done to get ready for these races. And Katie's got part one done. She got sub 24 at Western, which was her goal. So we're happy for her, but I'm getting ready to saddle up in a few days Hard Rock, and we'll see how it goes.
Now, Dominic, talk to us a little bit about Hard Rock, because it's an animal on its own. It's different than many other 100-mile races. So why don't you, number one, there's 140 people, I believe, that are allowed in the race each year, and some of the characteristics of the course I'd like to hear from you, because I'm sure you've studied it.
Yeah, I've been here for the past week and a few days, and I've been out on the course with Nick and Jamil Curry, who do Aravaipa running down in Phoenix, and they put on a bunch of races down there. But they've been coming up here for the past 4 or 5 years to the San Juans, just either vacation or to run the race, and they've given me a good tour of it. And basically, the big takeaway from the San Juans is that they're pretty much like the biggest stage in mountain running. I mean, these mountains are like, you know, almost every valley that you go through has between 6 to 3,000 foot relief. So, you know, if you come into a valley, you know, there's a 3,000 foot to 6,000 foot wall on each side of you.
Oh, wow.
And that's up to, you know, 13 to 14,000 feet. So I mean, this is like the canyons of western states on, like, you know, 4,000 feet higher, or I don't know, like 8,000 feet higher, and another, you know, 10 times steeper and longer. And it's just the real deal, I think, as far as mountain running goes. And I know, like, people like to compare races and stuff, but I mean, I did Angeles Crest last year. I've seen Western States course. I've seen, you know, a couple of mountainous courses out there, but this is just like a whole nother level. And basically the way it goes is people hike as best they can up the hills, and then they carefully fly down the hills, whether that's trotting down or you know, flying with reckless abandon. It's a real art form, and so you kind of get in this rhythm of just becoming a really good hiker. And I mean, there's definitely a big difference. Like, if you're a good hiker, you can maybe do 20-minute miles on this terrain, maybe 15-minute miles on some of the not so steep sections. And then if you're not so good of a hiker, you know, 1 mile could take you 45 minutes to an hour. So even though you're hiking, there's still fast hiking and there's slow hiking, and there's a big spread of how people finish. You know, the course record's 23 hours and the cutoff's 48 hours. So that year that Kyle set the record, he was done for over a day before the last finisher finished. So it's a big, big spread. Wow.
So this is like the first time that my 100 will be faster than his.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm feeling good. I'm feeling strong, but I don't know if I'm on a sub 24-hour pace this year at Hard Rock, because that's only been done once. So
you're gonna try.
I'm gonna try. Yeah, there's not too much snow on the course this year. It's pretty clear. You know, the weather's been actually pretty good. It's rained a bit, so it's. But the forecast for race day is only 30% chance of showers, so we'll see if it changes. But it looks like it's going to be a good fast year.
When you're training for a race like this, do you focus more on the uphill training or the downhill training?
You know, in this particular race, I mean, you know, Western, you'd say definitely downhill. Hard Rock, I'd say definitely uphill. The time spent moving uphill in this race is probably a good 60 to 80%, depending on, you know, what type of runner you are. And you know, for like the general standard for me is, like, on runs that we've done for the past week, we climb a valley in maybe an hour and a half, and we descend that valley in maybe 30 to 45 minutes. So that's kind of, you know, I guess that falls into that 75% to 60%. So hiking on this course is really important. And yeah, go ahead.
So would you say that your downhill strategy is the reckless abandonment, or?
Well, you know, Nick Curry, man, that kid is like, he's like 5'8 or 5'7, and he moves like a gazelle, just, you know, barely touching the rocks, just flying downhill. He makes me look slow, but I'm still a pretty good downhiller. I think my opinion for downhilling here at Hard Rock is to stay in the race as long as you can. And, you know, if you look at it like on a, I don't know, if your goal, 4 miles per hour here is a really fast average speed for the race. So if you could go uphill at, 2 miles per hour and go downhill at 6 miles per hour, that's 30-minute miles uphill and 10-minute miles downhill, then that would technically put you on 24-hour pace. So I'm not trying to impress anyone. I think I'm around around 8 to 9 minutes miles on the downhill, because there a lot of them are pretty technical. Some of the fire roads, I'm actually going to use a couple different shoes. I'm going to use a bit more cushion shoe for this 11-mile descent into Ouray. And then on some of the more technical sections, I'm going to use a thinner trail flat, sort of help feel my way through. I think my outlook for this race is, be really consistent with my fueling and my navigation. Don't get lost. And then hike consistently uphill and on the downhills, just stay in control and move efficiently. I think efficiency is the key word.
Yeah, I would imagine that with only 140 runners, there's a chance you spread out pretty quick in that group. And if the trail isn't marked well, you could end up, and you're not used to running it, you could end up somewhere where you don't want to be.
Yeah, it depends on who marks that section of trail. Some of the markers are, in the mindset of, this is a very historic course. You should study the map. You should be comfortable with it, and you just sort of, know where you're going and use land navigation skills. And I actually don't mind that. I mean, as long as it's not too much covered in trees, I'm okay with the cross country stuff, because there's parts of the course where there's no trail. You're just running over meadows and stuff, and I'm okay with that. But there's other parts where other markers are a bit more we don't want you to get lost. If you get lost here, this is a bad spot to get lost, and they mark it a little bit more lowly. So in general, though, this is a course where they definitely don't hold your hand and give you confidence ribbons like they do at other races. They give you, every time. So the markers are these coat hangers, basically, with they stick them in the ground. They have a metal placard that's maybe 2 by 2 inches, and it says, Hard Rock logo on it. And those are your favorite thing to see during the day, because that means you haven't gone lost yet. But
wow.
Tough love on the trail.
let's talk a little bit about trail marking, because some people get out of control. I mean, they're using miles and miles of ribbon, and as if their family owns stock in that ribbon company. and then they'll when there's no way to go off course, you'd either have to just jump off a cliff or run up a cliff, but they still put a marker there for you. And then as a person that comes by and helps clean the course, does a sweep, you ribbon people tie them with light knots. You do not have to tie them so tight like they're your 5-year-old going off to school shoes. Give them a little bit of relaxed ties on there so we can just pull them off and not do some tree trimming along the way. That's my rant. I had to talk about ribbon people.
Well, you know what, Don? When I was helping out at States, I actually thought you marked part of the course.
Why?
I don't know, because I was like, wow, there's a lot of ribbons.
Because
really
it was obnoxious.
Frequently.
I was trying to get back at somebody, get even.
I really did think you marked.
Well, here you don't really have to worry about ribbons. They're like stakes driven into the ground, because otherwise the marmots will eat the ribbons.
And
so.
No, it's stuff just gets trampled out here. Like there's elk all over the course, and they trample
and there's sheep
anything
the
that's
other
bright.
Day.
Yeah, there's the other day I posted some pictures of some sheep just all over the course. They were herding them on BLM land.
Mm-hmm. They just trampled all the markers.
Trampled all the markers. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
When you posted that, I was wondering if you were going to hitch a ride. Is that an automatic disqualification?
Is that muling? Is that muling to jump on a sheep?
yeah, those sheep were pretty wild. I have a video on my Facebook, and it's just this symphony of just raucous sheep just all over the place. I don't think that you could utilize them much, but but you know, on the main thing, there's definitely two schools of thought. And a couple of years ago, I used to mark the Xterra races, which are short, 10-mile race trail races around LA. And, I'd kind of give them knowing as how hard people run them. I'd give them maybe 10 or 20 yards if someone's going really fast down a hill, to give them fair warning, right turn coming. I'd mark it with chalk and stuff. And that's a race where it's just really about speed and stuff, and just, flying as fast as you can, and no one wants to, be slowed down by bad marking. And then this race, Hard Rock, is not, I mean, yeah, there is a, you know, a trophy for the first place winner, but for most part, no one in the race is really like, you know, that as excited about it as it is at Western States. I think people that come here are here for the experience, for the beauty of the mountains, and sort of to pay tribute to the Hard Rock miners who came in. I mean, there's just some amazing mines, you know, on the side of mountains that you're just wondering, how the heck did they get, you know, all these, you know, 2x4s and mine shafts, you know, drilled in the middle of these mountains. And it's just, you know, really tough miners that, you know, they wanted to find their gold, and they did whatever was possible to do it. And it's kind of a similar parallel with us as hard rockers, that, you know, we're here for like some of the most beautiful terrain and mountain running imaginable. And it's incredibly hard to finish this course, but, you know, it's, you know, you can't really figure out how everyone else does it, but one way or another, you know, the human spirit just perseveres on this type of terrain, and people come with their, with, you know, huge goals, and they get after it, and they achieve it. So the marking here is kind of in that vein of, you know, the miners didn't have, you know, markers telling them where to go, where the gold was, but they, you know, they had, you know, a little bit of help. And so, you know, you sort of pay tribute to that, and that you have to sort of study the course map a lot, and you have to, you know, do your homework and go out on the course if you can, and acclimate and see the trails and get a feel for it. And then when you do the race, you know, that's, it's definitely not, you know, something that's, you know, you can expect anything. Like you should expect, you know, the worst of the worst, because, you know, they could have remarked the section the night before, and some marmots could have chewed off all the ribbons, or, you know, the elk could have just come through and, you know, decimated the marker. So you kind of got to have a map on you and know what you're doing.
Well, no way would I run that race, because I, as much as I complain about all the ribbons, I kind of like them. I need some ribbons. I'm not an orienteering guy. I mean, if you put together a team and you said, well, we need somebody that can read a compass, don't even Google right past me. Last guy picked on the playground for orienteering. That's me. That's not my strength.
You just said you've never been to Silverton before. Once you got out here, you can't help it.
Yeah,
it's like Candyland.
Yeah, it's just like the miners' game. You know, the gold fever. You know, you get out here and you just get mountain fever. It's beautiful.
Well, I get altitude sickness. That's
you,
what
you
I
do.
No, I don't.
That's true.
So let's talk about tapering. Are you guys ready to kind of jump into our topic of the podcast?
Sure.
as we're into it about 30 minutes, here we are getting there. You know, so big races for everybody. And typically as runners, there's many of us that have a fear that, man, I don't want to stop my mileage. I don't want to stop my training intensity, because I'll lose my fitness level. Everything that I've worked for will disappear. And I do not want to sabotage myself by doing this taper. And you know, that's, I've been guilty of some of that, thinking, you know, how much is too much? What's not enough? And trying to find that sweet spot. How do you do it? So let's just kind of talk through some of that. And Katie, let's start with you, because you have completed States. Let's talk a little bit about your thoughts on tapering, your philosophy, and what you did, and realizing that we all might be a little bit different, right? That everybody has their own way to train. Everybody has their own way to fuel for a race. Some people do things completely opposite, but very successful. So let's talk about some of the things that you did to make your race successful and your running successful.
Awesome. That's a perfect segue, actually, about everyone being different and realizing that. Because I think previous to this, I used to be a little bit more regimented and just everything. Like, I have to run this many miles a week in this progression. I have to climb this amount of feet. I have to eat a gel every 30 minutes. I have to eat a salt stick every hour. And, you know, my taper has to be exactly 2.5 weeks, and I can't run more than this amount of miles or this long. And it was just very, I don't know where I came up with these things, but it was just, that's what other people seem to be doing. And so that's what I did. And I think that one of the best things that came out of this whole freak knee yucca thing was that coming back from it, I knew that I couldn't be where I was just in an instant. I had to really listen to my body and figure things out for myself of what felt right. And, you know, that kind of became my whole philosophy this whole entire year, where I stopped really paying attention to my watch. I stopped even looking at it to eat. I more just like listened to what felt correct to eat, and when I needed more salt, when I needed more sugar, when I needed more water. I just really, really listened. And lo and behold, my races started going better this year. And so, interestingly enough, I had planned going into Western that Dom and I went out like 3 weeks. What was that? Like 3 weeks before we went to Tahoe, I think so. We were checking out the high country part of the course because I hadn't seen the first 20 miles, and I had planned on maybe doing that and then running for like 3 or 4 more days to give myself almost a full three weeks of taper, but maybe more towards 2.5. I was still planning on doing a decent run the next weekend, and I kind of tweaked my calf a little bit. And so I was like, okay, well, I'll just kind of start an early taper and really listen to just kind of running every other day, only doing what felt right. Like, I stopped climbing right away and then kind of integrated hills back because I also didn't believe the way to solve the calf thing was to just like go completely stagnant and put it up. I knew I needed to work through it, and it worked. But then kind of what happened was before – maybe a week before the race, I was starting to feel really lethargic, and I knew I needed to kind of kick my butt into gear. And I meant to do that by just running a few hours, but I accidentally hiked Mount Whitney for like 9 hours, like 6 days before the race, which I didn't tell anybody because I thought people would be like, "What? You're crazy. Why are you doing that?" And even Dom was like, "What are you doing?" But I honestly, like, I wasn't pushing myself at all, and it was kind of what I needed to get my body back functioning again. And again, it's not like that was anything I had planned on. I was just kind of listening to what felt correct to do. And then, you know, for the rest of the week before leading into Western, I definitely only was running, I didn't run every day, and I wasn't running more than like an hour or an hour and a half tops, but it was more just to kind of keep things moving. And when I stood on the starting line in squat, I felt really good. Like, felt energetic, I was ready to go, I felt hungry. And I never felt lethargic during the race. So whatever I did worked, and it was all just listening to what felt correct, of that fine balance between doing too much or not doing enough and just feeling really, really crappy.
Learning to trust yourself and learning to run with some intuition. How important is that, just for not only in the tapering stage, but also during the actual run? Because you can't be regimented, because there's nothing regimented about an ultra marathon. There's so many things that happen along the way that you'll never predict. And so you have to be able to adapt on the fly. And your spreadsheet with all your, I take 2 capsules now and I'm going to have a half a goo here as long as it's orange, and all that stuff has got to go, because you've got to be flexible.
Yeah, that's, I mean, in any race too, I always prepare, even if I have a crew, which I did. I was so lucky. I had an awesome crew at Western, but I still prepared that if I got there and they weren't there, and it's a good thing. Like, fortunately, I didn't have to deal with it, but other people did, where some of the shuttles broke down and their crew didn't get there. And it was just kind of crazy, but I had prepared going into the race, and mentally before every aid station, I'm like, okay, this is what I'm going to get from my crew. If they're not there, then this is what I'm going to do. And it just, like, I don't know, it's never really stressful for me that way, and adapting on the fly and just doing what I need to do. Sure, I might be like, darn it, I really wanted to get my sunglasses or whatever, but those are all things you can live without. Is if you can still use what they have at the aid stations or use your brain while you're running, then you tend to not get too stressed out. And I think that's what actually kills people in races, is that they depend so much on things being perfect, and then when they don't, they get into a really bad mental space, and that's actually what breaks you down, not the actual physical part of being short one goo or something like that.
I think the goal is to show up like you did at the starting line, feeling anxious, feeling like your legs have some springs in them instead of, you know, carrying around a couple of cement cylinders, that, you know, but showing up fresh and showing up anxious to run. That, I think, that's when you've peaked and you're sharp and you're ready. That's the goal of, let me at it. I can't wait to get to run and get out there.
Absolutely.
I think the way that you get to that point, Dawn, is different for every person. And I think we'll find that through talking to Dominic. I don't know Dominic very well, but from what he posts on social media sites, I'm guessing that Dominic...
You follow him.
Yeah, I do. I follow you, Dominic, so beware.
Thank you.
But I don't think, Dominic, your approach to tapering, I think, is even a little bit different than Katie's.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, I come from a technical background, a mechanical engineer during my daytime hours, and I think of...
And I just make shit up.
Yeah, there you go.
Katie writes stuff that sounds cool. I make stuff that's cool. Same thing. So, you know, I think of, like, you know, your body, you know, you have to have, like, a little bit of an organic approach and a little bit of a mechanical approach, because a lot of times some feelings that you have, some gut feelings, can sort of be, you know, due to other things that are going on in your life. Maybe, you know, you had a stressful day at work and that kind of wore you out, so you think that you should taper more, and really you're running, you know, the running side of your life may be just fine. You know, maybe you should go for a little bit longer run. I think, you know, what you basically have to do is use a rule between 1 to 3 weeks, depending on how well your body's been recovering. And, you know, you sort of have, like, an idea through your training. I think when you have peaks and valleys in your training where you sort of ease back on the mileage and you see how well your body responds to rest. You know, this year, like, I do, you know, a big week of, like, 130,000 feet or something, and then I'd sort of ease back for a couple days and let the legs rest and stuff. And so for Hard Rock, I've sort of got that organic feel dialed in from already having that objective, you know, approach to it. And also, you know, I've sort of had some general rules in my training of, you know, my last long run is about 15 to 21 days out. So, you know, 2 to 3 weeks out is my last long run. And then I start, you know, getting more rest, and I try to keep it under 2 hours for 2 weeks out, and then under an hour and a half to an hour week before. In the case of Hard Rock, because it's such a long race, and, you know, I think for me, also I'm on vacation here in Silverton, hour and a half a day this week is okay. Maybe an hour for the last couple of days before the race to get really ready. But, you know, if I'm doing like a 50K, like the taper may be different. You know, I may be doing some strides in between to sort of, you know, make sure my fast switch muscles are up to snuff. Like, I haven't done any speed work. Actually, I've done one track workout this year. I haven't done almost any speed work for Hard Rock, and I've just sort of been in that climbing mountains and descending the mode. And so I feel comfortable when I'm sort of easing down the intensity. Like today, we went up Bear Creek for 3 miles, and I turned around and on my own and just, you know, enjoy the trail, relaxed, made sure, you know, I had little spurts of hard effort, and then I just relaxed and stuff. And I think general idea you already hit on the head is that you show up on the line anxious and ready and rested, but you don't feel you know, out of shape or anything. So so that's what I do. I think at the end of the day, you know, you're going to have that organic feeling in your body, and just try not to do anything too crazy. That, you know, I mean, I err on the side of a little bit less is my opinion. Erring on the side of more kind of like puts a bad feeling in your head during the race. So that's what I go with.
Totally. I definitely agree with that. I rather feel like undertrained than overtrained, kind of thing. Going to the start line, I rather feel anxious than feel like in dread. Like, oh, did I do too much the week before? Was I on my feet the last day, you know, last couple of days before the race too much? So I think that's one thing that I've learned that is really difficult for me, is kind of turning off that mental head game. As you know, if I don't train for 2 weeks, if my taper is 2 weeks, am I going to lose that endurance? And that's such an inner battle that a lot of people have, is I'm going to lose my endurance going into this big race. And it's just, that's not true.
Yeah, I'd say it's kind of like, you know, you have to know your demons. And one of the biggest and most common demons of ultra is feeling underprepared. And ultra runners always want to do more work. That's just our nature.
Sure, you're always underprepared. You're never fully prepared for anything. You just have to be confident that what you did was enough.
Well, I think that, like, you know, in my opinion, like being prepared is just being ready to do the race to the best of your ability. And if, you know, you think, like, if you're always second guessing yourself, you just gotta, like, remember that demon is always going to be there. And I mean, like, you know, I'm hanging out with Dakota and Joe this week, and they're nervous. And, like, these are two, like, the most fit guys in the race. And they're nervous about, you know, whether they're ready or not. And they've done tons and tons of homework. So it's, if you feel nervous and you're at the middle of the pack, back of the pack, front of the pack, it's something we all share. And you just got to remember to be confident.
You know, in the last 2 to 3 weeks, I don't think that we've already established, and there are studies out there that show it, that you're not going to lose strength or endurance in those 2 to 3 weeks. I imagine if you're in bed rest, you can have some muscle atrophy, but none of us are in bed rest. We're out there still going through some of the motions. And one of the things that they talk about in some of the things that I've read, and I'm going to link a couple of articles to the end of this podcast, and one from the United States Olympic Committee, which is timely because we're in the Olympic stuff right now that's going on, and they've done a lot of great studies out there. And one of the things that they show, the reason that we do feel better is a lot of the cortisol and the testosterone and those ratios and the different enzymes that we have in muscle glycogen all go in the right direction when we get a little bit of rest. And then they've done some studies with some swimmers and some mid-distance runners and found out their performance increases by 3.5% if they've tapered properly. And you start doing that in a 24-hour run. I did a little math before this podcast, just my homework. And I said, what's 3.5% of, I'm talking to a mechanical engineer, he might correct me if I'm wrong.
Careful.
Yeah, 3.5% of 24-hour event is 50 minutes. That's a lot of time. You know, to come in if for a proper taper. And so I think there is a lot to the taper and a lot of mental to the taper as well. If you learn to trust the taper and find out what works best for you. One of my best runs that I ran over my head, I would say, what happened over my training, because I didn't train as much as maybe I would it for other races that I've done, but the last week my family was out of town, and all I did was go home, eat some ice cream, and go to bed. For a week, I ate ice cream and slept a lot, and I showed up just ready to run, healthy.
Yeah.
A little overweight. Well,
what you said is good, too, because, like, we're talking about, like, how many miles we run and things like that, but one of the biggest things for me in my taper is making sure that no excuses. I'm not staying at work super late every night. Like, you know, I work in advertising and things can get crazy sometimes, but I make sure that I just put my foot down and I don't do that. I make sure that I get a full 8 hours at least of sleep every night. I make sure that I'm eating really clean and that I'm only eating foods that agree with me. I'm making sure that I'm getting enough water every single day. And I do that for almost a month in advance of a big race, at least 3 weeks. And it has nothing to do with running. It has everything to do with everything else.
Yeah, and you know, we were talking with Joe Grant the other night, and we were sort of discussing, you know, what really good runners basically are. And, you know, we were talking about Olympic marathoners, and it's not, they're all in great shape. You know, everyone's getting ready to run a race and taper, and they're, you know, they're fit, they're ready to rock and everything. But the ones that win are the ones that are mentally confident in what they've done. So, you know, if your taper, like you said, is eating ice cream and going to bed, and that makes you confident, that is completely golden, because you show up on the start line and you don't have any inhibitions about, you know, throwing it down. You know, if you show up and you say, oh, I've ate too much, I don't know, and you just feel like you've done something wrong and you don't feel confident and you haven't done it how you wanted to do it, then you're going to sort of have these, you know, things creep up in your head, and you have excuses like, you know, I should have done this or that, or I didn't do enough speed work. You know, all you want going into a race is confidence, and your taper is a reflection of, you know, that you've done the work, the hay's in the barn, and you're confident with yourself, and you should enjoy it. You know, and I'm pretty much enjoying this week. I'm pretty much living like a dirty hippie, just going on different trails and checking things out, and, you know, just living the good life. So getting ready to go to work on Friday morning. So,
oh, we're gonna have fun following you on that. We'll keep a close eye. You know, our bodies need to repair during that taper too. We've done all the work. We've really worked and trained that cardiovascular system, but one of the things that we need to do after all that hard training is let some of the things like the meniscus, you know, and our just different cartilage and joints and muscles just repair so they're totally ready and ready to go do the work.
And I think during that taper period, I always experience, this is the worst part of tapering for me, is the phantom muscle pains that come along with healing a meniscus or whatever.
Yeah, I'd say just go trot around outside and you'll realize they'll go away. Your muscles are pretty much like used to a load on them. And when that load's taken away, it's kind of like you're in outer space or something. You know, it's just, I get those twitches at night. You know, I know that feeling.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting too, you bringing up like everything repairing itself is I wonder if kind of, you know, I said the biggest shock of running Western for me was that my knee never hurt the whole time. And I kind of wonder if I definitely haven't tapered properly for races leading up to it, because this was kind of the big one. This is the one I cared about. And I wonder if it was because I finally gave myself enough time to allow all the work I'd been doing and the way that I pushed it to try to re-strengthen it, that I finally had like 3 weeks for it to just chill. And it did not hurt at all the entire race. So there's something to be said for that, for sure.
Absolutely. But I had something I wanted to add in there and I forget what it was. Oh, heck. It was so good too, guys.
I would like to say that ice cream technically has protein in it. And in one of the articles that we're going to be linking, it says protein enters the muscle fibers and repairs the micro tears in there, which is what's happening when we're training so hard, is just a bunch of little micro tears. So eat on.
Eat on. So since you said that, I remember what I was going to say.
Excellent.
Yes.
Oh, man, I must be getting some serious age on me, because how can it disappear again? End of the day. I'm in taper mode. Yeah.
Micro tears. Overtraining. Not overtraining.
What are you guys, what are your thoughts? And hopefully it comes back to me. What are some more thoughts on some that you've learned through your trial and error of tapering? What's a takeaway that you could share with somebody that you want them to know?
Don't overdo it, definitely. I err on the side of caution. Also, you know, have your taper kind of be proportional to the work you put in. It's like your first race of the year, you know, and you've done maybe a month of hard training and you don't really feel like you need, you know, a solid 2 weeks, then, you know, make it like 10 days, make it 7 days. You know, you want to like just kind of come in with this. It's kind of like if you ran out of gas and you're like coasting down a hill, you want to coast right into the gas station. You know, just enough momentum to stop at the pump, that would be perfect. So just adjust and stuff, you know. I think just remember too that, you know, the haze in the barn, you know, you can't add anything to it. You know, just be confident and celebrate the hard work you've done. Take it in that perspective. Don't take it in the, okay, you know, I'm just goal oriented all the time in my training. And now my goal in tapering is to be as sharp as possible. Well, you know, it's a 100-mile race, a 50-mile race, even a 50K. You know, there's a couple miles where you're gonna warm up, and you don't have to have, you know, speed work every day or something or strides every day. Katie.
Well, I think we've already hit upon most of what my main piece of advice would be, of just being confident in whatever choices you did make to do, whether they're the same as another competitor or not. Like, just be confident in what that was and show up to the line and say, all right, I'm ready to do this. But another piece of advice would be more related to, everybody talks about taper crazies, taper madness. And I don't know if it's just because I'm a girl and I'm emotional anyway, but that definitely sits in with me, where I will have a day where I everything is bothering me. And I luckily have learned to like recognize that and realize it's just like my body's adjusting to lack of the same activity that I've been doing. And maybe I'm even like emotionally sad that I'm not as much in the mountains as much, or I don't know what it is, but I've kind of learned to realize that and maybe like forewarn people or understand when that's happening and be able to just back away or lock myself in a closet or do something to be away from the situation so that I don't start having stressful situations in the other parts of my life too, just because maybe I'm going a little bit nuts because I'm nervous about my race and my body's all jacked up and what that is. So just paying attention to those emotional cues and trying to get those in check as well.
Amen. Amen, sister.
Is that true, Dominic?
Yeah, she has locked herself in a closet before.
Oh, you guys bought me some time because I remembered what I needed to say.
Go, Don.
And I wrote it down. And Faith gave me gave me that major eye roll when I had to finally write it down. And it's intensity. You know, it's to go ahead and taper from the reading that I did on here, and I believe it's true as I try to rationalize it to myself. It says you need to keep you reduce your volume of training, but your intensity should be about the same or a little bit higher. So just going and trotting around easy, slow, and reducing your miles too may not be to your benefit. But trying to keep some of the same training intensity you had in there so that your body recognizes, hey, this is the workload we need to do. We need to go out there and make sure that we don't, you know, give up glycogen stores that we have, or mitochondria are going to go put them to rest. We need to have this kind of demand on our body coming up. So we better keep all these stores here, but we just do less so we can recover.
Yeah, definitely like have that muscle memory of what it's like to, you know, cruise around, 6-7 minute pace, and then also to hike up a hill hard. I know, you know, what, like the run that Dakota and Joe and I did the other day, it was kind of a little bit hard on the out through Pole Creek and then a little bit easier on the way back. And, you know, just a little bit of mix of everything, and that definitely is an important part.
Let's translate 6 or 7 minute miles to the rest of us. 10 to 12 minute miles. Okay.
You know, just we'll say heart rate, you know, on the 150 to 180 beat per minute range. That's that type of stuff. Yeah.
I can relate to that. I understand that. I think my piece of advice comes from just gaining experience, because so much of running to me, my running is very much mental. I'm a middle of the pack runner, so I'm not very intense, but I have a lot of head games when I run and a lot of head games when I'm preparing for a big race. So for me, it's recognizing that my head will play games with me up until the moment that, you know, they say 3, 2, 1, go, or whatever, when you're on the start line. So being proactive and controlling those head games and positive talk through affirmations, or just doing whatever I need to do to get ready for a race mentally. That's what my taper consists of.
Definitely. That's the organic confidence that's got to come from within.
Now here's another piece of taper that's somewhat, I've morphed this use of the term taper, and that's running the race and actually tapering a little bit inside the race. And so I just did a hilly course, and it's part of like the Miwok course out there, and you guys are familiar with that at the Marin Headlands, lots of up and down. And I thought about taper, and then I thought about taper within the race, and I thought about taking the downs and getting myself healthy for that next up, mm-hmm. and trying to regulate my output and what I had in my reserves and recovering and putting out throughout the race, and started using tapering within my race in a sense. Hmm. Any thoughts?
Well, I actually paced Katie the last 10 miles, and she did not taper during the race. She,
yes, I did.
She crawled down to Stinson Beach for sure.
But, at Miwok.
At Miwok, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but I learned I didn't do that at Western. I had still had legs.
You've got to take care of yourself throughout a race. You've got to. I talk about like it's a crystal that you're carrying through, and you can't crack it, because once it's cracked, then it's damaged goods, and you have a mental crystal and a physical crystal, and you've got to try to keep them, you know, healthy, and you can't impact them too much, because when you do, then they're broken. And so I use that race to make sure that as my effort and my output and my fuel intake and my effort output are all within the thickness of my crystal, Faith. That my thickness.
You're so wise.
Yeah.
Well, that's definitely, I think, what I kind of took away from Western too, with the whole just not looking at my watch and really being confident in what I was doing in each moment. And I would think about it too, like everything that I was doing would be, can I go a little bit harder, or am I going a little bit too hard right now? Am I going to blow myself out? Like, I've got to have legs later. And I really, it was weird too. Like, I never really kind of took in the rest of the course. I just stayed really within the moment. Just every single step was very focused on how can I make this better? How can I make this the most efficient? Yeah. So I don't know if that plays in, but that's definitely was kind of my mantra the whole time. And because of that, I don't care what the time on the clock would have said. It was a good thing that it was right under 24. But even if it wouldn't have been, well, if it would have been 24:01, it would have been bad. But whatever the time would have ended up being, I would have ended up still really, really satisfied in what I'd done, because I was smart in every single moment, and I was in those moments. So
yeah, that's good ultra running.
Yeah, I never have done that before. It's amazing.
I think, you know, the great thing about ultra running is that there's so many different ways to run a race, and there's so many different, so much potential for like excellence. You know, you can have, you know, 80%, 90%, 100% race, and the best ones are kind of where that you'll see the pros do, is where they're just real patient, and you know, they're running hard, but they're patient. And then when the moment comes in that particular race that's intense, they drop the hammer and they run well. And you gotta know each race really well. You know, Western States Forest Hill is definitely a start line in itself for the big dogs. You know, I think here at Hard Rock, I don't know, I'd say Ure or Grouse, which is like 45, or at a 50, or 58 or so, you know, around there, around midway point in the race, people really start moving. And you know, for your own mental outlook, I think, you know, mentally being a little bit tapered earlier in the race, you know, that when the gun goes off, it's definitely a race from the start, but that you sort of have that expectation that, you know, when the pain train really comes, you know, the halfway mark or the 2/3 mark, that you're ready to respond. And that's definitely a good point. Don't make any mistakes where, you know, the way I describe it is just had a piece of bread and you're spraying some Nutella over it. You know, you want the Nutella to go all the way to the end. And, and if you come up a little bit short, then you got to dip into more Nutella, and it's inefficient. You know, and then you don't know if you have enough, and you know, you just want to spread it nice and evenly. That's your race plan. You know, even output all over the race, and every inch of the course counts. You know, from the first mile to the last mile, and if you have to run a little bit easier at the start to make it to the last mile, then that's the way you've got to do it, and that's the way really good times to run. So.
Ultra running, good until the last drop.
Well, we've had crystals, we've had Nutella analogies, we've got all kinds of ways to taper and to run a race, and it's gonna be exciting to follow you, Dominic, through Hard Rock, and know that you've done your work, and it's great to get to share that in that with you.
Yeah, that's the magical part when I'm on the trail. And I know someone in some part of the country that I've ran with before is cheering me on. It's a big makes me feel really, really, really special. So I'll be thinking of everyone out there.
And you're running for New Balance as well, right? I said that about Katie, but you're also a New Balance team runner.
Yeah, Katie and I are both New Balance and Injinji, the great toe sock company.
Yeah, I wear those.
For sport, and then I also run for Power Bar and Salt Stick, and Team RWB, which is the Wounded Veterans Program. They help to get veterans from our recent wars back out in endurance sports, whether it's with prosthetics or you whatever. They help them do that. So.
Excellent.
That's good stuff. You know, we're missing Scott Ward tonight because he's with his family out on a beach, and we mentioned that in the beginning. But I know that if he was on this podcast, he would say this. You know, I'm so jealous of both Dominic and Katie. Those guys are always out traveling. They just live for running. I see they're camping over here, climbing this mountain, then they're over here because he follows along on Facebook or Twitter, and he says, man, those guys have the life.
Yeah, well, we're in our 20s. We know that more responsibilities will come, so we're just making the most of it now.
Right. No, I'd say, like, you know, at first I started to do a lot of races in ultra running, and as I've like this is my fourth year coming up now, and I've sort of started to get those special races dialed in, and I think that's a really fun part of ultra running, you know, putting in a lot of work for a race, getting really prepared, and then just enjoying it. And Katie was super excited at Western. I'm super excited for Hard Rock. You know,
well, I'm still excited. I'm excited for you too.
Yeah. We're just brimming with excitement here. So
we better let you get to sleep. We better let you get to sleep. This is part of your taper, and here we are dragging you into the middle of the night out there in Colorado.
Well, thanks for having us. It was a great conversation as usual with you guys.
Thanks for coming on.
Katie, thanks for being there. If you want to find Dominic on Twitter, we're going to link it, but it's Young Gun Ultra Run. And Katie, you're on Twitter as well?
Yeah. I'm just Katie Splinter. I don't have a cool thing.
we'll link you as well. So best of luck to you guys. Rest up. Continue with your taper, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Awesome.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Well, Faith Goss, I think I need to lay down and taper.
That was a really awesome podcast, and it's always great to get everybody else's, you know, taper experience, what other people do, just different people mix it up, and it's always great. And I could bond with Kate over the whole mental part of it. I get into an ugly place when I taper.
You want to
stand back at least 10 feet.
It's a good thing you're not running the same race and are roommates.
Yeah.
No one would want to be around that house.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it does show that we all have a little bit of insecurities when it comes to that. Even the most fit people on the planet, and as Dominic was talking about, think a little bit about, did I do enough? Should I do more? And the rest of us looking in saying, are you kidding? You know, I wish I could do that much. I wish I was in your shape.
Well, Trail Runner Nation members, go up, join the site if you haven't, start a forum, start a chat, follow us on Twitter at We Are Nation, and you can find us on Facebook at Trail Runner Nation. Now go out and
run
Moss. Baby, you're looking fire hot. I have you open all night like your IHOP. I'll take you home, baby, let you keep me company. You give me some of you, I give you some of me. You look good, baby, must taste heavenly. I'm pretty sure that you got your own recipe. So pick it up, yeah, I like you. I just can't get enough, I gotta drive through. Cause it's me, you, you, me, you. All night, have it your way. For play before I feed your appetite. Let me get my ticket, baby, let me get in line. I can tell the way you like it, baby, supersize. Hold on, you got yours, let me get mine. I ain't leaving till they turn over the clothesline, check it. Take my order, cause your body like a carry-out. Let me walk into your body till you hear me out. Turn me on, my baby, don't you cut me out. Turn me on, my baby, don't you cut me out. Take my order, cause your body like a carry-out. And let me walk into your body till it's inside. Turn me on, my baby, don't you cut me out.